Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin today and zeroing in on a couple to start the show. There's an invasion of leaf beetles, and we'll talk about them with P.J. Leash. P.J. back with us. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always great to have him come by to talk about bugs in general, but we'll zero in again on those leaf beetles a bit and certainly take your bug questions. What's bugging you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you have a cool photo of an insect, or maybe you want to identify an insect and have a photo of it, feel free to email us that photo at ideas@wpr.org. Or again, call us at 1-800-642-1234. PJ, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
Yeah, great to have you with us. So leaf beetles, leaf beetles, there's a heck of a lot of them out there, aren't there? Different species and
stuff? Oh, yeah. Yep. Leaf beetle itself is kind of a general term. It refers to a specific family of beetles, the family Chrysomelidae, and it's a very, very diverse group. We see species on milkweed and garden plants, and a lot of them are minor pests, or they just don't do a whole lot of damage, and they're just kind of part of the ecosystem, but there are some important pests in the group as well.
Yeah, and the viburnum leaf beetle is one, and the lily leaf beetle is the other one that you're a little concerned about here.
Yeah, these are two species that I've been watching in the state now for about 5 years, and they have an interesting story, and the story of these two insects, even though they're different species, there's a lot of parallels. They're both from parts of Europe and Asia, and they both showed up in North America right around the time of World War II. So they've been
around a while.
They've been in North America for a while, but they were kind of slowly expanding their range in eastern Canada. Both species made it into New England area back in about the 1990s, and then they've kind of been spreading westward since then. And both species showed up in Wisconsin and became established back in about 2014. So I've been watching them very closely for about 5 years, seeing where they're moving around the state.
And where are they moving around the state?
Well, so if we look at viburnum leaf beetle, and this is a species that feeds on viburnum shrubs, and that includes American cranberry bush viburnum, with folks like to grow for the red berries and things like that, some native arrowwood viburnums and things like that. So it feeds on those. We have seen it. The first detection I had was in far northern Milwaukee County, so kind of that area where Milwaukee, Washington, Ozaukee, Waukesha County all meet. That's kind of the epicenter.
Okay.
And so that was about 2014, 2015. It was there. Year or two after that, it popped up in Oshkosh area, which came as a surprise because that's a decent jump on the map. And it's slowly been spreading around southeastern Wisconsin, which is kind of what I would expect to happen. But then this year, we saw two big jumps. The first was earlier this summer, a colleague up in Iron County, up in Hurley area, at the extension office there, had a sample come in. So we confirmed it there. And then my colleague actually lives right across the border in Ironwood, Michigan, found it there as well. And I reached out to my counterpart at Michigan State, and he didn't have any records of it from western part of the UP either. So there's this pocket in northern Wisconsin. And then ironically, about 2 weeks ago, there was a fairly warm Sunday. My wife and I were wandering around Middleton, an area that we live. And sure enough, I saw it on some bushes. They leave very distinctive holes in the leaves and an egg pit. So we confirmed it there. So that one showed up very, very recently, or at least we detected it very recently here in Dane County.
So what do they look like? How big are they, and what kind of features do they have?
Yeah, so this viburnum leaf beetle, the adult beetles are actually fairly hard to detect because they are small. They're just under a quarter inch long, and they're an olive greenish yellow color. So they blend in pretty well on leaves and on the twigs of the shrubs. But what they do is they chew these oval-shaped holes in the leaves that are fairly distinctive. So once you learn to recognize that, that's an important clue you can use to look for them. And I did see that on the shrub that I found them on. another thing that they do that's very distinctive is the females, when they go to lay eggs, they lay eggs in batches of about 5 or 6 eggs. And they literally chew these little pits into twigs. They lay a batch of eggs and they cover it up with sawdust. And they'll do that again and again and again. So I was finding these rows of the egg laying or overposition pits on the twigs. That was a definitive sign that they were there.
So what do we need to be worried about?
Well, they can cause significant damage to viburnums. And the thing is, when you look at viburnums, there's a lot of different species and there's different varieties and cultivars. And some of the species really get clobbered and can be killed by this insect. And unfortunately, because it's a non-native pest coming from parts of Europe and Asia, our native viburnum species really get clobbered by this one. There are some cultivars that are more tolerant or resistant, and for whatever reason, the beetle just doesn't like to feed on them, so we get pretty minimal or low damage on those. But some of the viburnum species and cultivars really, really get clobbered by them.
So at some point, you're going to be talking about those viburnums that are resistant.
Yeah, there's a pretty good range of them out there.
Okay.
And that would be something if I were going to be putting some shrubs in my yard and I wanted a viburnum, I'd probably do some research online to figure out, you know, what are the best ones that are available at local nurseries.
And you can find them on, you can find info about?
Yes. Yep. I have a fact sheet available through UW Extension where I discuss some of those.
Cool.
So you can find some of the names of cultivars and start looking at those if that's something that you're interested in.
And up on your site as well?
Yes.
So, and your site again is?
Probably the easiest way to find it, if you did a Google search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Yeah.
Should
it'll
be able to find
it. It'll pop up every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
right off the bat. Well, I want to ask you about the lily leaf beetle as well, but Gene and Cable's been waiting around a bit, so let's go to Gene. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, hello. I have not seen leaf beetles, but I will watch for them. My question is, my husband hunts grouse, and I've been noticing this year that when he brings the grouse in and cleans them, there will be like a fly-like creature that escapes into the house. And it's sort of, it looks like a fly, but it's a slow-moving, kind of a louse-shaped body, flattened. And it's like parasite on the grouse. And I'm wondering if there's any danger to dogs or humans as far as maybe disease-carrying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my suspicion, I'd have to see it to confirm, but there's a group of really unusual flies called louse flies or sometimes ked flies, and they are true flies, but they have kind of a bizarre appearance. They're often very much flattened, and and if you're a parasite, being flattened is a very common theme, so you can kind of smush your way between feathers and hair and things like that, and you're able to hold on better. So my suspicion is it's probably one of these louse or ked flies. Family Hippoboscidae is a name for it. There's actually a lot of different species of these out there. Many of them are associated with birds. I just came back from the National Entomology Meeting, which is going on at the moment in St. Louis, and I saw some talks about these from out in Pennsylvania. They're surveying them, getting a better feel for them. There are some concerns amongst birds that these insects might be involved with some bird diseases like avian malaria and things like that. They're still trying to figure out if that is the case. Overall, the way I view these, though, in terms of human or pet health, probably really pretty low risk.
So nothing to worry about, Gene, and you are lucky that you have a partner who is a good shot and can bring home grouse because they are the best eating bird out there as far as I'm concerned. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Well, Drew in Lake Mills has something for us. Hi, Drew.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. I've got a question for your guests with regards to emerald ash borer, except these aren't ash trees. These are black walnut trees. These are oak trees. And we have, I was on a walk this weekend. I have a black walnut tree in my backyard, which is dying, which has the symptoms of emerald ash borer. And on our walk, we witnessed a property which has a bunch of oak trees, which are marked, which have the same kind of disease. Holes everywhere in the tree, the bark peeling off. The bark has a grayish appearance. And I'm wondering if your guest has any idea what insect might be affecting these trees.
Yeah, so interesting situation. My first impression is almost certainly not emerald ash borer. Emerald ash borer really is pretty darn specific to true ash trees. However, when you start looking at borer-type insects that are going to be tunneling beneath the bark or into the wood, there's an amazing diversity of things. And I remember being an entomology student and for various classes, and if you wanted to find a lot of insects, especially maybe it's time of the year where there's not a whole lot out and about and flying, you could go and peel bark off of trees and find all kinds of things. Many of these borer-type insects, though, are what I commonly refer to as secondary borers, meaning that they don't go up to a healthy tree and start attacking it. What they usually do is they go to trees that are compromised, stressed for whatever reason. The trees could be stressed due to disease. They could be stressed due to winter weather or flooding issues or just about anything under the sun. And then once those trees are kind of running ragged, then these opportunistic borers get in and start causing damage. So what you could do in this case, if you were to send me some pictures of like those exit holes on the outside of the tree, that would perhaps give me some general indicator. Another option you could do, if you were to cut off like some branches and send them into my lab, I can peel off the bark and get an idea for what type of larvae are under there. But again, I suspect it's almost certainly some of these secondary borers. On oaks, for example, there's a close relative of emerald ash borer called two-line chestnut borer.
Yeah.
But again, that one goes after primarily stress trees. With oaks, you know, we've got oak wilt concern and other things going on. And my counterpart, Brian Huddleston, saw a lot of trees with foliar diseases this year because it was so rainy. So a lot of things can be going on. As I said, once a tree is kind of compromised, then the secondary borers get in.
Andrew, thanks a lot for calling. You know, as you were talking about that, I was thinking, in pretty much every case that I can remember, the insect isn't after a healthy tree to begin with. It's always, as you say, there's something wrong that creates an opportunity for the insect.
Exactly, yeah. And it's kind of interesting along those lines. I mean, if we look at insects that are invasive, so not from here, like emerald ash borer,
right.
I tell folks it's a kid in a candy shop unsupervised. There's not those natural checks and balances when it came from Asia to get here. And so that's why ash trees get killed so readily. Kind of the opposite, though, we have a native borer that's closely related to emerald ash borer called bronze birch borer that goes to stress birch trees.
Yes.
And it's from North America. But if you take a European birch species and bring it here, it tends to get hit pretty hard by that insect because it just didn't evolve with it.
PJ Leash, our guest today, he directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. Great to have him along. Questions or comments for him, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us your photo and or question at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dan and Stevens points on a photo wondering what this black insect, black and white, it's kind of an interesting one.
Yeah, so this actually looks like one of the orb weaver spiders.
Yeah.
And given the general appearance, it looks an awful lot like a species I would commonly call the bridge orb weaver, which often is on bridges and structures and things like that. So that's my suspicion, is that it's probably that species or a very close relative from that family.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. And Colin in La Crosse emailed this photo of, how would you describe that? Sort of brown with some white stripes or yellowish stripes?
Yeah, so
it's pretty.
This is, it definitely is. This is one of our larger moths in the state. This is the white-lined sphinx moth. And this is a species that, despite being a moth, can be active during the day and tends to have hummingbird-like behavior. So a lot of times folks will think they've seen a hummingbird. You take a closer look and say, something's not checking out here, and it's often this particular species.
PJ Leash, our guest today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the world of insects today with our guest, PJ Leash, from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and the Department of Entomology. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Well, we've had a few questions about small flies. Sam in Madison has another one. Let's go there. Hi, Sam. Thank you for calling.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have some plants that we put outside on the deck during the summer, but we brought them in for the winter leaf-by window. And we think that the small flies, they look like fruit flies, have come in on a couple ivy plants. We put the plants outside, kind of just gave up on keeping them because we didn't want to keep the infestation around. They don't seem to gravitate towards the fruit we leave out in the kitchen, but they won't go away, and they kind of just show up randomly, wondering if there's something to do about them or just a typical fly trap might work for them.
Yeah, so when I think of indoor plants, and especially plants that were outdoors and then were brought indoors, one of the top suspects in my mind are fungus gnats.
Yeah,
And these are going to be similar in size to fruit flies, but they have a darker appearance. And for a lot of the species, the wings are kind of dark, translucent, kind of grayish, blackish. So take a close look at the fly. See if they look like that. And the story with these is they feed on decomposing organic matter. So outdoors, it was horribly rainy this year. So they had great conditions. If you want to find them outdoors, you go to a compost pile or rotting log or leaf pile, something like that. But again, they can occur indoors in house plants. And what that often tells me is that the house plants are maybe kept a little on the damp side.
Yeah. The other way.
Yeah, exactly. I've had some issues with these in indoor plants in my own office, and one of the simplest things I do is water less frequently. If that soil starts drying out quite a bit between waterings, that makes it really inhospitable for the larvae to survive because the larvae develop down in the soil where you have decomposing leaves and things like that. And so often just over the course of several weeks or a month or two, watering less frequently can be an important step. Another thing you can try, if you go to the hardware store or garden center, you can buy these sticky card traps. And they look like a neon yellow index card, but they got sticky glue on it. And they usually come with a little stake, and you can put those in the potted plants. And the adults will kind of come to those being attracted to the card a little bit, and they'll get stuck to it. That alone isn't going to get rid of them, but if you do those sticky card traps or glue board traps in addition with watering less frequently, that can often do the trick in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Be careful, though, if you have cats.
Yes. Anything
sticky. Who wanna bat at
that? Anything sticky with cats wouldn't be fun.
There you go, Sam. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jake in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I am trying to understand just this fall, we recently had a bunch of perfectly healthy ash trees sawed down that had no brown leaves on them. They were really beautiful trees. And I wondered about the logic of cutting down trees ahead of having any signs or symptoms of sickness at all. Can't some of these trees start beginning to build resistance to emerald ash borers? And we wouldn't know that if they're already sawed down. Why not cut them down when they're dead or dying?
Yeah, so good question. There's a lot of different things that could be going on. Part of it, especially in urban forest, is the urban foresters have to look at the bigger picture. I mean, in a place like Madison, thousands and thousands and thousands of trees. And they may have to look at a budget and see sometimes they can treat trees, sometimes they can remove some, and trying to spread out those costs over time. There are, of course, insecticide treatments that can protect individual trees, but you have to keep doing that. In terms of the trees developing resistance on their own to this insect, that's very, very unlikely to happen. If you were to look out in the woods where, statistically, it's a numbers game. There's a lot more trees. We are seeing evidence in places like Michigan. There are some surviving ash that eventually they may incorporate into a breeding program. But another aspect of it is, especially in urban areas, you have to look at the location and setting of that tree. You know, if this is a tree that is going to be facing constant attack by an insect like emerald ash borer, and maybe it's near power lines or it's hanging over a bus stop and things like that, ash trees tend to get extremely brittle compared to other trees. You can have, we have out in the woods standing elms that had died from Dutch elm, and they're still standing.
Yeah.
Ash trees, if they die usually within about 5 years, they're probably going to come down. They get very brittle and very dangerous. So sometimes it can make a lot more sense to cut them down and remove them while they're still in decent health, because if you wait until they're truly dead, I mean, branches can come off very easily, and that can be quite hazardous in an urban environment.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think the city of Madison, like a lot of cities, made a big mistake in planting an almost monoculture of ash trees. We did that with elms 50 years ago and had the same problem.
Yeah.
Once they're all there. And so I think, Jake, what I'm hoping is if they cut those down, that probably next spring there may well be some new trees in there of a different variety that's not susceptible to that. And I think the goal now is to try for a broad range. Am I not right on that?
No, you're exactly correct. I mean, you know, urban foresters and city planners have learned some of these lessons over time. After Dutch elm, and a lot of cities had lots and lots of elm trees, they kind of looked at trees that would be hardy, resistant, or kind of more tolerant to soil compaction, salt, and ash trees fit that profile.
Great. So they
were and they were you know, really pretty good for a long time until emerald ash borer came in. That was a game changer. So these days, urban foresters really are putting a lot of emphasis on diversifying that urban forest. That way, if something else new comes in, it's not going to take out 10 or 20% of trees. It'll take out a much smaller percent.
So there you go, Jake. Hope that you have some new trees maybe to look at next spring. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Jerry in Green Bay. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great subject. I have a kind of a two-part question. Number one, for your guest, with all the experts out there now in his field, do they feel that the emerald ash borer is going to take out all the ash trees maybe in Wisconsin as far as the oak wilt goes, the same thing? And then where they come from, I don't know, Europe or wherever, has that been the case? Has that disease or insect decimated the whole forest land? And I'll take your answer off the air, and thank you.
All right. So the ash borer and then the oak wilt.
Yeah. So for oak wilt, that would really be a better question for Dr. Brian Huddleston. He's our plant disease expert at UW. But in terms of emerald ash borer, I mean, the outlook for ash trees in Wisconsin, the Midwest, is not good. We are seeing some evidence in places like Michigan. There are surviving ash trees where clearly emerald ash borer has gone through, killed off ash trees, and there's some survivors there. We call those lingering ash. And so scientists are trying to take a close look at those to see, do those trees have some genetic trait that allows them to survive better? Maybe they've got better chemical defenses, or we're still trying to figure that out. But in the big picture, it's probably going to take out an awful lot of them, and that's going to have some really significant impacts on the landscape. We're seeing it already in urban areas, especially southeastern Wisconsin. What really is kind of worrying to me is northern Wisconsin hasn't seen a whole lot of emerald ash borer yet.
Yeah.
There's still about 20 counties in northern Wisconsin where we have not found emerald ash borer. And if you get into some of those areas, especially swampy areas where black ash is very, very prevalent, sometimes it can be 75%+ of areas up there. That's going to have some really significant impacts in those areas.
And thanks again, Jerry. Did we cover everything? Yeah, I think we did.
I think so.
Yeah, we did. Jerry, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, well, let's go to John in Richland Center. Hi, John.
Hi. I built a solid oak log cabin out of squared off red oak trees 30 years ago. And I like red oak. It's good. But I'm 600 feet higher than the Mill Valley in Boaz. In other words, the Driftless region is the location. 600 feet above the Mill Creek in Boaz would be where it built this house. It's a cabin.
Yep.
But I'm wondering about termites, and I've seen pinholes, and it looks like maybe carpenter ants.
On the logs of your cabin?
Yes, drilling in my cabin, and my cabin is 18 inches off the ground.
And they're drilling in on, I'm sorry, are they drilling in on the inside or the outside?
Yes, yes.
Both?
Inside.
Oh, inside.
They make a real fine sawdust.
Okay.
Well, so I almost wonder, there might be two different things going on.
Yeah.
Of course, carpenter ants can be really common out in the woods and you know, you have a log cabin structure. Wouldn't surprise me at all if they show up there. Main thing with carpenter ants, though, is they don't like to go to dry, good, sound wood. They prefer more of damp wood that's starting to decay to a certain extent. So if you're aware of any moisture issues, that may be a component. Sometimes, though, carpenter ants can set up what we call satellite colonies, and you'll have a main carpenter ant colony out in a rotting log or stump in the woods, and some of the workers will move in and take a batch of larvae with them just to a hollow void or cavity. That might be up in a roof area, something like that. So that's kind of the story with those. For the small holes with the very fine sawdust, that sounds like powder post beetles to me.
Yeah, for sure.
And we do see these very commonly in log cabins and old wooden barns and other structures and things like that. And these are native insects that are common out in the woods that go to standing dead trees and those sorts of locations. But if they're getting in and causing some damage to log cabins, we're certainly not going to be happy about that. In terms of what you can do, there are treatments that can help with those. It can be rather labor-intensive, though. There are a couple products that are based with borate, like salts, and these would need to be painted or sprayed onto the wood. The caveat, though, is that if you have any type of paint or varnish coating the wood, you'd have to strip that off first. Otherwise, it just isn't going to wick through. But these borate-based products, Timbor is one of the names of them, T-I-M-B-O-R. There's a Boracare. And these are sold by log cabin companies that build cabins and things like that. And once they get into the wood, they're a long-term wood preservative. So if insects are in there feeding, they ingest it, it's a stomach poison, it can kill them. So that can be a helpful approach and perhaps one of the commonest things that would be done in the situation. But again, that would involve a lot of work because you'd have to strip off paint if those logs
if
are sealed.
If they're painted, yeah, and sealed of any kind, even a clear seal.
Exactly, yeah. See, you'd have to strip off that stuff. You'd have to apply the borate-based product and then kind of reseal everything. So it can be very labor-intensive.
The good thing about that product is that in terms of human health and so forth, there's not much of an issue or no issue.
Yeah, generally pretty safe for humans. You know, historically, we have had borax soap and stuff like that,
sure,
which has almost the same kind of thing in it. So relatively safe for people, but it can be labor-intensive to apply.
There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to another John, this one on Oconomowoc. Hi, John. John, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
It's me.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I'm a certified arborist in the Lake Country area outside Milwaukee, and first question about magnolia scale and the treatment thereof. Is there anything better than a dormant oil in the spring? And also to touch on the emerald ash borer and like the brittleness, it's like tripling the cost of the removal. It's unless people don't want to find cleanup. So I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. That's a good comment about the brittle nature and the cost.
Yeah, that is. For this magnolia scale, dormant oils are one part of the equation that can be used. To my mind, you kind of have to look at how severe the infestation is. And magnolia scale is something that I saw lots and lots of about 4 or 5 years ago, based on conversations with arborists and tree care folks. Seems to maybe be on the upswing again. Had several conversations with folks later this summer and received some of those comments. So it's definitely something out there that can damage magnolia trees. So the dormant oil is one approach that can be used, and for a low infestation, that might be enough. Otherwise, other options include some of the systemic products, but then I have concerns about pollinator health. Luckily for us, magnolia blooms, one of our earliest plants to bloom in the year. And so if you wait till after it's bloomed, that would help minimize risk to bees. So that's an option. I've heard of arborists using some of those products. Otherwise, with magnolia scale, the adult insects are bizarre looking. They kind of glue themselves in place and cover themselves with a waxy protective coating. So they're hard to target with sprays. The juvenile stage, though, that we call crawlers, are pretty wimpy and easy to kill. The critical thing, though, is knowing the right timing. And each scale species is different in terms of when those crawlers are active. And for magnolia scale, it's basically at the very end of summer. So essentially early September. And if you're scouting for them and monitoring for them, one trick that I have heard about, you can put like masking tape around the branch on magnolia that time of the year. And if the little crawlers are active, the wander crossing gets stuck and you'll see them on it. So when the crawlers are active, then you can target them with your standard kind of general use tree and shrub insect spray. In theory, even insecticidal soap can kill them, but again, it's a matter of timing it correctly.
Contact with that, yep, I assume.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Peter in Eau Claire will give you a chance now. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi. I apologize if you've covered this before, but you were talking earlier about the emerald ash borer. We've got an ash tree out front. It's really beautiful, and our concern has been about the ash borer. What we've done is we've been working with an arborist to give it treatments. I think he injects something into the tree. My wife knows more about it than I do. But my first question is, how effective are these kinds of treatments? I don't know what he's using. What's the impact on the environment for pollinators and just in general for other creatures living in the area?
Okay. Good questions, Peter. Thanks a lot for calling.
Sure. Yep. Great questions. What I suspect is probably being used, it's probably trunk injections of an insecticide called emimectin benzoate. And some of the common trade names are Triage is probably the commonest one. There's a handful of other ones out there as well. And that is kind of one of the gold standards that folks are using for this pest because it's A, very effective, and B, it provides multi-year control. If you were to read the fine print on the label for those products, it says it protects trees for 2 years at a time. But there's a lot of research that has been coming out. I had been involved with some research myself here in the state several years ago where we looked at this. We injected trees and kind of watched over time. And there's a lot of data suggesting 3, in some cases, maybe even up to 4 years of protection for those trees. So in some cases, folks are treating their trees every 3 years and getting very good results from that. So they can be very effective. The tree has to be in good health to start with. If the canopy is really thin and you're starting treatments, you know, that's hard to tell if it's going to be effective or not. But if the tree was in good health at the beginning, typically those respond very, very well. The problem is in the long run, you have to keep doing those treatments.
Yeah, it's every 2 or 3 years for life.
Exactly, yeah.
More or less.
Scientists have conversed about wondering over time when the EAB wave goes through, are their populations going to be less and maybe we won't need these treatments as often, but we just haven't gotten to that point yet. So for the time being, you have to keep treating those trees on a very regular basis.
And if you've got a tree that sounds like it's a wonderful tee, it's probably worth $100 or so?
If you have an arborist do it, it's going to depend on the size of the tree. It may be in the ballpark at $200 to $300.
$200 to $300.
In a lot of cases, it's going to depend where you are in the state, that sort of thing. The product they inject tends to be pretty expensive stuff, so that's part of it. But again, if you look at that cost and say you're only doing this every 2 or 3 years, that kind of brings
$100 a year,
average, right?
It's
right.
Worth $100 to save that tree.
Exactly, yeah, because trees can be a big component of value of your home and your yard, provide shade and things like that. So it can very much be worth it.
Peter, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. A couple of photos in. Bill in Oregon sent a photo of flies. They are quarter size, the size of a quarter. He collected them in August 7th, clinging to a building on the isthmus near the Yajara River. And he's wondering what those tubes are that are projecting down.
Yep. So these are a type of mayfly, and I'd have to zoom in and really look at some of the wing venation to narrow down a family for you. But off the back end of the insects in this image, there's these long yellow tubular-like structures. Those are basically batches of eggs that they're laying. And as adults, mayflies tend to be very, very short-lived. They may live 24 to 48 hours, so they emerge often in large numbers. They mate, and then the females are going to try and find water again to lay eggs. Sometimes they end up doing this on the side of buildings, though.
I remember driving across the Wisconsin River, a bridge across the Wisconsin River in the summer, and there was a mayfly hatch, and there were, I mean, it was 4 inches deep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
On the road.
Yep. I see and hear cases like that along the Wisconsin River, also near La Crosse in the Mississippi,
yeah.
and parts of there. We will see it usually, you know, once, twice a year, where you get a huge emergence of these, and it'll show up on National Weather Service radar, where it looks like a thunder cell popping up, and it's just insects emerging simultaneously from the river.
That is so cool. You know, you talked about the one photo from Bill in Oregon with the eggs, and here's Ann and Madison emailed a photo. It looks like large clumps of pollen on a milkweed plant, wondering if it is, in fact, insect eggs.
Yeah, so I'm taking a close look at this. I don't think that these are eggs. And to listeners out there, so what we're looking at in this picture, it's a stem of a milkweed plant, and there's these small, round, yellowish objects. And these appear to be oleander aphids, which is a species of aphid that happens to really love milkweed. They'll often kind of coat the entire stem, sometimes the developing seed pods as well. One of the commonest insects that I see on milkweed plants around the state.
That's interesting. I wonder if we could put that up on our blog. Jill, can we put that up on our blog? We'll see if we can put it up on our blog, which you just go to WPR.org/Larry and then look to the right side. You'll see where our blog is. And there are some other things on that blog anyway that are kind of fun to look at. But maybe if we can get that photo up, we'll do it. It's kind of interesting for sure. Well, let's see. Should we go to Marcus in Madison? Hi, Marcus.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for the valuable service. A more humble, modest, urban-based sort of question.
Okay.
I have never been much for pets, but I seem to have one. It's a small spider. I would say he's got a leg span about the size of a 50-cent piece. He is sort of blonde in color, sort of a smallish body, with what appear to be little balls on the end of his legs, his appendages. He seems to live near the stove in my kitchen and travels along the corner between wall and ceiling in just about every room. He's completely innocuous, and I've had him for about 9 years now, and I'm wondering if this could possibly be the same spider, or he lives here all winter long, too.
Yeah, probably not the same spider.
Right, exactly. Yeah, probably not the same one. Probably, you know, you very easily could have the same species. And yeah. In the state, we've got about 500 or so species of spiders. There's not that many that are well adapted to live indoors, but the ones we have indoors can do pretty well there, so you can see them on a regular basis.
I have one that shows up every year on the side mirror of my car. I think it gets inside the side mirror of the car, and I come out, and there it is, and sometimes on the glass, and then it goes right back inside when I drive away.
Yep. Yeah, there's some. I've seen that myself. A lot of different spiders out there. When you start taking a look at them and learning about them, they're really pretty fascinating
pretty
creatures.
Cool.
Yeah.
And Marcus, good for you for letting that spider live. I mean, it's just it's doing its job. It's probably getting some other insects, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. They'll feed on insects indoors, so free pest control. There are some indoors that feed on wood lice, or we call them roly-poly sometimes, that sort of thing. So yeah. In general, they're feeding on other creepy-crawly things around your house.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. PJ Leash, our guest today from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Always fun to talk about insects, I think, anyway. I hope you do as well. And that's what we're dealing with here on the Ideas Network, the world of insects, from the perspective, in some ways, of PJ Leash, who directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's at least the expert here to answer your questions, and certainly you can join in. We have an open line at 1-800-642-1234. We've had some great photos. You can email us your photo and maybe a question along with it at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. So join on in, and let's go to Scott in Wausau next, who has a question. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Hey, it's been a great show. I've learned a lot this hour. But the question is, my wife is dying to regrow lilies, so can you delve into the lily leaf beetle and how to get rid of it?
Sure. So lily leaf beetle, which we haven't had a whole lot of time to talk about on the show yet, so I'm glad you brought it up for us, Scott. So I mentioned before it is originally from parts of Europe and Asia, showed up in Canada, eastern part around World War II, New England 1990s, and then Wisconsin in about 2014. And because you're in the Wausau area, you're right in the epicenter of it. That's where we first had it show up, and it appeared nearly simultaneously in a bunch of different spots within Marathon County. So general Wausau area, that tells me it probably came in with some plant material. Mm-hmm. Folks bought it, took it back to their yard, and all of a sudden it moved around. So it's been interesting to watch because for several years it's been expanding its range slowly, you know, down towards Stevens Point and Portage. Now it's made it up towards like Tomahawk area. So there's a cluster of counties in the state there that have been dealing with it now for several years. We had some new detections up in like Price County, for example, but then some surprises this year. It made some big jumps on the map, showed up near Ellison Bay in Door County, which is a big jump from Wausau area. Showed up here in Madison in Dane County, and then it showed up way in western Wisconsin in Pierce County. So it really made some jumps around the map, and it's going to be interesting to watch how it spreads out of those areas in the coming years. But this is an insect that feeds on true lilies. So it doesn't feed on things like daylilies. It doesn't feed on canna lilies or calla lilies or things like that. But true lilies can really get clobbered. And I have been to meetings with commercial flower growers and had conversations with folks growing flowers basically in central Wisconsin near Wausau, and they've stopped growing lilies because this insect is so damaging to them. So if you have a yard with a lot of lilies, this is going to be a very, very difficult pest to deal with. If you have, a few clumps of lilies or something like that, there are ways you can go out and deal with it, but it's going to be a very labor-intensive process. I know folks that are maybe retired, and so they're going out every day and knocking the adults or the larvae into a container of soapy water. That's one approach. You could spray them with insecticidal soap or a soapy water solution. That can work as well. But again, those two approaches have almost no residual protection, so you have to do it on a daily basis.
Yeah, and the contact things.
Yep. In theory, you could use some of the general landscape insect sprays to control them. But again, I get a little nervous because these are flowers, so we don't want to be spraying that directly onto the flowers because pollinators are going there. They're going to bump into trouble as well. So it's a very, very challenging pest to deal with in the state.
But you can, some of the daylilies or some of the others are really not effective.
Right, exactly. So if you like the general appearance of the flowers, one simple thing you could do would be to maybe transition from true lilies to more daylilies. And there's lots of, different types of them out there. So that may be one route, or simply diversifying your other flowers that you have in your yard.
There you go, Scott. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Gregory in Lake Tomahawk next. Hi, Gregory.
Hello. Hi. Guess what? I just moved to my new house about a year and a half ago, and I have a, I believe it's an ornamental crab tree.
Okay.
All right, and that we were looking at it the other day again, and it's like, it seems like somebody with a machine gun pellet, or not a pellet, even a BB gun, the trunk is just filled with all these indentions in it. They don't go up to the branches or nothing. I'm going, is it from sapsuckers or a bug or what?
And it goes right straight through to the through the bark, totally?
Nope. It just it's into the bark a little bit. That's
just
it.
Just into the bark.
And are the holes in straight lines or a grid-like pattern, or are they kind of scattered randomly?
It's almost like if you had some kind of funny vegetable cutter. Just yeah, it's very interesting how it's very systematically put into that tree bark.
Okay. In a line.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Much.
Yeah, that's the clue I was looking for. That tells me it's probably sapsucker damage, and that's not unique to crab apples. A lot of small trees will get some sapsucker damage along the way. I've seen trees that get it, and they seem to grow out of it just fine, and as they get older and the bark is thicker, you know, the tree just tolerates it quite well. I've seen some other cases, though, where if that sapsucker goes all the way around the tree and does a lot of extensive of drilling into the bark, then that tree may kind of suffer some impacts from it. But because it's in that very regular pattern, that's a strong clue that it's sapsucker injury.
And it's not going to be too bad?
Well, it would depend on the extent of it.
Yeah.
I know David Drake has some bulletins on dealing with woodpeckers. There may be ways to kind of wrap the bark so that you have a physical barrier that may discourage them. But otherwise, not an insect in this case.
Gregory, thank you very much for calling. Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, PJ and Larry. I was just wondering, we're going up north hunting after deer, and I heard that the deer ticks are really, really bad yet. And I don't like to use all those chemical sprays. And all of a sudden, it popped into my mind when we used to do insect collections back in school. You take a jar and you put a little alcohol on a cotton ball and the bug would be dead in a matter of minutes. I was just wondering, if you came back and put all of the clothes you just walked in the woods into a garbage bag and you put a rag in there with rubbing alcohol on, would it kill the wood ticks or would they only laugh at you?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if you had a little container with rubbing alcohol or strong ethanol in it, if you drop ticks in there, they're going to die. We actually use about 70% ethanol in the Wisconsin Insect Research Collection to preserve specimens. So it's widely used for preserving ticks and mites and spiders and insects, that sort of thing. If you just were to throw in a rag with some on, I really am not sure how well that's going to work, if at all. However, a very simple thing you can do, heat can kill them. So if you come in with your hunting clothes, if you even just throw it in the clothes dryer on hot for 20, 30 minutes and kind of cook them in there, that would be lethal to them. So that's a very simple thing that you can do. But again, if you're not using the repellents, that may give them a chance to get onto you. So myself, if I know I'm going out in an area with high tick activity, I personally like the repellents and taking other precautions, perhaps tucking pants into socks and things like that, because when you hear about these tick-borne diseases, it's some pretty scary stuff.
And these permethrins that you can spray on your clothes are generally considered safe.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of different repellent products. I mean, you can get your DEET and Picard and other things like that. And those can be applied in some cases directly to skin, depends on the product, sometimes to clothing. You got to read all those fine instructions. But as you just mentioned, Larry, there are products that contain permethrin. And permethrin does two things. A, it has repellent properties. B, it technically is an insecticide. And if they touch it long enough, it can kill them outright. There are some repellent type products you can get at Gander and REI, places like that, outdoor stores that are designed to be applied only to clothing, and you don't do this while you're wearing the stuff. You kind of, you know, lay the stuff out, you treat your clothing with it, and that's going to provide some long-term protection. And just as a matter of perspective, the same ingredient, permethrin, is sometimes used in veterinary medicine. Sometimes it's used in human medicine for treatment of scabies and things like that. So again, it's not something you'd apply directly to your skin. You need to follow all those directions, but that is registered and can be another important precaution you can take if you're going out in tick areas.
I usually use that in the spring for turkey hunting season, or when you're out early in the spring of the year, it's a good thing to have on your clothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can get a little bottle for $8-$10 and treat your boots, pants, and jacket.
There you go. Thanks, Thomas. Appreciate it. Linda in Three Lakes. Hello.
Ooh. Hi, guys. Am I on the air now?
Yes, you are.
Okay, great. I have a problem with earwigs. I have a vineyard with 100 vines in it. And when it comes to harvesting the grapes, there's just a lot of really disgusting earwigs on them.
Yeah.
Is there anything I can do?
They like to be around vineyards.
Yeah, I mean, with earwigs, the main thing I think of it is they like damp, kind of tucked away spots. So it may be, in the bigger picture, trying to treat for those might not be the best option. I would look at ways to increase airflow, light, that sort of thing. That might be, you know, more pruning or changing your pruning practices. That might be changing kind of the ground cover. You know, if you have a lot of grass that's growing up, that might be some good habitat. Or if you have mulch beds or something.
Heavy mulch.
Yeah. This year and last year, I mean, with the rain we had, it was just good conditions for them. If we had a hot, dry year next year, I would expect you to have fewer earwigs. So weather is going to be part of the problem as well.
So people don't like earwigs. Nasty looking things.
Yeah, I can't think of really many fans of earwigs that I know of.
No, and earwig wouldn't be a good name for a rock band either.
Nope.
No, it wouldn't. PJ Leash, our guest today, he's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We're going to take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with PJ. In the meantime, shoot us an email at ideas@wpr.org if you got a photo, or you can call and just wait online at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, just before the news break, I said the earwigs would not be a good name for a rock band. And Jill Nadeau, in her wisdom, looked around and found out that there is a band named the Earwigs. And you're now listening to some music from the Earwigs. And that'll be going away pretty quickly. And you will be hearing the dulcet tones of our guest today, PJ Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always great to have him come by and talk about earwigs and all kinds of other insects. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo you want to include, please go ahead and put that in your email as well, because we always love to see those. So again, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And we have a caller online, so let's take a call from Peggy in Grantsburg. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I have a question. I noticed some defoliation on a branch of my pagoda dogwood in September, and it's not a very large dogwood. It's only probably 8 feet tall and maybe 4 feet wide. But I went out there to investigate, and I found some green and gold worms underneath the leaves, and I I call them packer worms because obviously because they're coloring, but they look just like them. And I picked those off and I squished all those worms. And then I continued to monitor it, and I saw there's a little more defoliation. Sure enough, there are more worms. And I looked online to find, and I, you know, got disposed of all of those as well. And I looked online to find out what it was, and I saw something called like a sawfly, a dogwood sawfly.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if what I should expect next year. I'd like to do, you know, some organic methods of control. I don't want to do any chemicals, but what should I look for? What should I, you know, expect in terms of damage? That sort of thing.
Sure. So there is indeed a dogwood sawfly, and that is probably the commonest insect pest I see on dogwoods. They're these caterpillar-like creatures, although technically they're more closely related to ants and bees and wasps. So the adult insect is kind of a wasp-like creature in appearance. Main thing with these, if you just have a single dogwood or a few dogwoods, you can keep an eye out for them. They start appearing, the larvae, about mid-July, so kind of mid-summer and more of a late-summer pest is when I see a lot of the damage out there. So I would start keeping an eye on those particular shrubs or shrub in July and kind of watch a couple options you could do if you have the time and you can check it regularly. The hand-picking that you've been doing, or if you can knock them into a container of soapy water, that can be very effective. Again, it's time-consuming, labor-intensive, but that is an option and no spray needed whatsoever. And as you mentioned, they tend to hang out on the undersides of leaves. You have to be thorough when you're looking for them. Sometimes they will be kind of green and yellow or black and yellow. At other points in their life cycle, they have kind of a waxy whitish coating. So if you see those, it's the same insect. They're just different kind of color patterns at different points in their lives. Some other options you could try for organic options, insecticidal soap can kill them. But again, they're on the undersides of the leaves. So you'd have to be really thorough in terms of spraying, getting the spray wand in there to get the underside of the leaves to get to them. You could try pyrethrins, which are an organic spray. So you could do that as well. I would also expect spinosad to work. So Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew is a common name of that one. Those would be kind of the go-to sprays I would try if I want to try something organic.
And there you go, Peggy. I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. PJ Leash, our guest today, and here's Jerry and Racine with an email to ask if there's a good way to keep the mealy bugs on his yews in check or gone this coming growing season without using pesticides.
Okay. Well, in a case like that, I would say the size of the plants and number of plants is going to be an important factor, and also how extensive the insect infestation is. With mealy bugs on indoor plants, for example, one of the common approaches we can use is you take a Q-tipped dipped in rubbing alcohol. I know folks that do this with orchids and various other indoor plants, but again, that's going to be very labor-intensive if you're dabbing rubbing alcohol into every single mealy bug you have on your plant. So if you just have one plant or two plants and there's not that money, that's one approach that you could try. Would be the Q-tip with rubbing alcohol. Otherwise, you could generally keep an eye on it. There are a lot of natural enemies that will feed on mealy bugs and other soft, kind of squishy insects outdoors. There are predators, there are parasites, and so on. And so if you're taking a look at those plants and you're seeing a lot of, like, lady beetles or lacewings, that may be a clue to me that there are some beneficial predators and parasites around that may help take care of the problem for you.
And thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it very much. You know, one insect that has not come up on the show, and it's the rare time that it doesn't, is the Japanese beetle.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how across the state, you know, you get information across the state on them. How's it been this last year?
Yeah, so I was pleasantly surprised from my viewpoint at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, the reports I was getting. They didn't seem to be too bad this year. If we go back a year ago, 2018, lots and lots of reports of damage. That was a very high population year for Japanese beetles. This last summer didn't seem too bad. Part of that may be the polar vortex that we saw. And I actually saw the same pattern. We had the polar vortex back the winter of 2013 to 2014.
Mm-hmm.
That following summer, they were kind of down statewide. And I saw a very similar pattern this year. This summer. So they were kind of down. Interestingly, though, because Japanese beetle isn't native to Wisconsin and the northern part of the state, we still don't see much of that insect, if we see it at all. But in the last year or two, I have had colleagues reported up in Marquette, Michigan. I've seen it a couple times in General Minocqua area, Oneida, and have had some reports from Vilas County, Eagle River area. And then we had a confirmed report up in Bayfield County, which is as far north as you can get.
As far as you can go.
Even though their populations were down, this insect has really kind of spread its range to almost the entire state at this point.
You know, I was wondering earlier this fall, we had that sudden, really cold snap in southern Wisconsin. And of course, I guess the north was cold too. But I thought a quick snap of cold weather like that wondered whether or not it would have some impact on Japanese beetles or other.
Yeah, that's a good question. For Japanese beetles, I wouldn't expect it to do a whole lot.
No.
And the reason for that is the larvae, that's a life stage they overwinter as. They're down in the soil.
Okay.
And usually we get towards end of summer and into fall, and they start moving deeper. And they may spend the winter. I've technically dug up grubs for an experiment years ago in December when there was snow on the ground, and we had to go down about 8 to 10 inches. And so if they have moved down deep enough, even if there's a rogue cold snap, they're down deep enough, they're going to be fairly well insulated at that point. So I wouldn't expect that to have much of an impact on Japanese beetles.
At least on Japanese beetles.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a call. Mary in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that I used a poisonous spray, a pesticide, which I don't normally use any in my yard at all, but my ornamental tree, a Harry Lauder walking stick, was heavily infested with the Japanese beetle. So I went out and bought some pesticide and, like the direction said, saturate it to the saturation point on the leaves. But then the leaves dripped off all the poison to the ground and it was absorbed by the roots. So the tree actually died, half died. And it's still there. It maintained some leaves, so I kept watering it, and it's still alive. But it was double-dosed, and that was my comment.
Yeah.
And Mary, do you happen to know what product you used?
I don't. I don't have it here. I mean, it's in my garage.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask is the products you and I can get at the hardware store or garden center, those are typically from a group we call the pyrethroids, which tend to stick where they're going to. And if they were to get into the soil, they don't really move or get absorbed by plants. They're not a systemic type product. So I don't think that the plant would have absorbed it from the soil, that sort of thing. What can happen, though, and I personally am not very familiar with this walking stick tree that you had mentioned, every particular pesticide product out there, there's always a chance for something we call phytotoxicity. And that basically means you apply the stuff to the plant and the plant just reacts badly to it. It might be not even the insecticide that's in it. It might be the other ingredients that just happen to irritate the plants. So usually when you read through the fine print, it says on there, you know, test a small area of the plant first and see how it reacts. Because sometimes we do get these phytotoxic reactions and leaves might turn yellow or brown or kind of wilt, maybe even fall off. So I actually wonder if it might be something more along that route, is it's a phytotoxicity issue.
Yeah, that makes some sense. And sometimes the chemicals, the sun, if you've got direct hot sun, can have an impact on the leaves as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors, and the problem is, especially for landscape plants, is there are so many different types of plants that the companies can't test all these potential what-if situations, so usually there's a little disclaimer on the label saying, you know, test it. Sometimes if they know that a particular plant is really sensitive to it, they'll list it on there, but again, they they just don't have the ability to test all the plants.
Yeah, Mary, I'm sorry about your plant. Keep watering and let's see what happens with it. Thanks again for calling. A good point. It really gave PJ a chance to talk a bit more about phytotoxicity, which was great. John in Toma will give you a chance now. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you today?
Yeah, I had a thing about the Japanese beetles. There was a way that I used to get rid of them in the fall of the year when they usually seem to swarm real bad, you know, warm days and cooler nights. But I used to take segregated cardboard and put it on the south side of the house because they'd seem to all congregate against the side of the house. And in the evening, they'd move into that corrugated cardboard, and then when they got in there after dark, I'd roll it up and burn it in a burn barrel to get rid of them.
Well, that's one way to do it. What do you think, PJ?
Yeah, so I think what we're talking about in this case isn't Japanese beetles, but multicolored Asian lady beetles, or yeah. Sometimes we just call them Asian lady beetles. And these are the lady beetles that like to sneak into your house in the fall, so they can be a nuisance in that regard. And you know, what you said makes sense. It's going to be hard if you have super high populations of those getting in. And this year, last couple years, they've haven't been terribly abundant in a lot of parts of the state. But again, they're looking for overwintering sheltered spots. And so if you were to put out corrugated cardboard, you hit on the fact that they like the warmer southern or southwestern side of the house. So if you give them those hiding spots and then you trap them in there and you know, do something to it, burn it or whatnot, that would be one way to get rid of them.
That's for sure. Thanks a lot, John, for calling. Appreciate it. That's a good, not a bad idea at all. And that's another a question that has not come up today that surprised me a little bit, is we haven't had anybody calling to say, oh, I've got Asian lady beetles in the house, or I've got box elder bugs in the house. So maybe people are tightening up their homes outside a little bit.
Well, that could be part of it. Otherwise, this year and really the last couple years, I think the weather is playing an important role in things. Asian lady beetles were pretty quiet. We had a couple warmer, sunnier days in like October, and I saw some activity, but very, very few calls and complaints about those. For box elder bugs, I had almost no reports this
year.
Turns out with box elder bugs, if it's rainy, you have a year where there's average or above average rainfall, they come down sick with a fungal disease and it kills them off. And so last year, the biggest group I saw box elder bugs was maybe a couple dozen. This year, I was seeing a few lone box elder bugs and that was about it. So the rainy conditions help keep those in check. If next year were theoretically hot and dry, I would expect their numbers to creep back up.
What about those stink bugs that have landed in Wisconsin in the last few years with the shield sort of shape?
Yeah, so that's the invasive brown marmorated stink bug.
I was trying to remember the name of it. Thank you.
Yep, and that's another one that likes to sneak indoors in the fall. Very similar story this year to last year. We've got some core areas of the state with a lot of activity here in Madison, Dane County, down to Janesville, Rock County. That's one hot spot of activity. Greater Milwaukee, Waukesha area, another hot spot of activity. And then the Fox River Valley, like Oshkosh, Appleton, especially up towards Green Bay. A lot of activity up there as well. Again, being fall invaders, they try and sneak in the fall. Added, I think, one new county confirmed in the state with a detection. Otherwise, very, very similar story to last year. They're out there feeding on plants during the summer months, and then they're trying to sneak indoors in the fall.
And one more, there was an insect that was attacking raspberry plants in the state, and I wonder just how that's been progressing, because they've really created some problems in certain areas of the state.
Yes, so I suspect you're referring to spotted wing Drosophila. Yep, these little teeny fruit flies. They look like your run-of-the-mill fruit fly you'd see in the kitchen, but the males have a black spot on each wing. That's why they get their name of spotted wing Drosophila. Drosophila is the genus of fruit flies. They had a pretty good year. And really the last couple years, they're widely distributed around the state. They seem to be doing fine with our winters. They kind of form a cold, hardy adult stage later on in the year that can survive through the winter, so for many, many months at a time. And then they get going in about June or July. So a lot of complaints this year, at least because it's been in the state for several years, folks have a pretty good idea of what it is and have learned to recognize it. But it's out there causing a lot of headaches for raspberry growers.
And it attacks the fruit, right?
It does, yeah. And that's an important distinction, because your run-of-the-mill fruit fly is really looking for kind of decomposing compromised fruits. But this one can go to perfectly sound fruit. And the reason it's such a pest is the female, her eggling device, it looks like a hacksaw. It's got teeth on it, so she cuts a little slit, and then that's an entrance point into the fruit. So a lot of headaches for raspberry growers.
So as we look at the past year, and then we look ahead to the coming year, anything in your crystal ball?
Well, I mean, the two leaf beetles we talked about earlier today, and other invasive species as well, I tend to see on average about two or three new non-native insects showing up every single year. So it's always interesting to see those. Keeping an eye on that brown marmorated stink bug we talked about, emerald ashborn, and things like that. Otherwise, every year tends to be different in terms of what are their main insect pests and what ones are a little bit more on the quiet side.
And one more that comes to mind is with our houseplants. Now, I did have, I'm not sure what I had. I didn't identify the insect, but there's a couple of them that are flying around my lime tree. And I had a little irregular shaped hole on a couple of the leaves.
Okay.
And of course, it was outside all, and I brought it in. So
yeah, I would wonder in that case. You know, there's lots of potential things outdoors, and many of those I would expect to be a problem primarily outdoors and probably not survive well indoors. So especially over the next couple weeks or months with dry air, if those had come in, probably wouldn't survive very well. Otherwise, I think of fungus gnats. Some of the aphids might still hang out on it, some mealybugs and things like that. There's a fairly short list of indoor plant insects.
I'm thinking of maybe fungus gnat.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but I think it might be fungus gnats. Well, somebody asked me once about the job that you do. You work at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. Talk a bit more about your background and what got you into a position like this. And are there other positions like this anywhere?
Sure. So growing up, I spent a lot of time outdoors catching frogs, toads, salamanders, fireflies, that sort of thing, and really fell in love in high school with biology. I had some good biology teachers, and so I knew when I went to college from day one, I wanted a biology major. It just fascinated me. And then this was early 2000s when emerald ash borer was just detected in Michigan. We hadn't found it in Wisconsin yet, but I got linked up with an entomologist here at UW-Madison. I did two summers of survey work looking at ash trees, especially in southeastern Wisconsin, for signs of that insect. Didn't find it at the time. We found it a couple years after that. But that kind of opened a door for me to come here to Madison, do my graduate work in entomology. I studied June bugs or June beetles. Mm-hmm. After that, I worked as a researcher for about 4 years. And then everyone knows Phil Pelletieri, but he retired right around that time, and then I transitioned over to the diagnostic lab. So
did you have a course from Dan Young?
I did, yes. pretty much anyone that goes through a department takes a class with Dan Young.
And I've talked to several people. I've had students who are entomologists, and I asked them how they got started, and they said, well, I took a course from the intro course from Dan Young in entomology, and I just fell in love with it.
Yeah, he's such a charismatic instructor, and that's very true. I think a lot of students hadn't thought much about entomology. They take his class, they fall in love with it, and then they change course.
So you're going to come back and be with us again, if I'm not mistaken, I believe, on March 18th, and I bet you there's going to be a little more insect activity picking up about that time, you think?
Maybe. Depends on how much snow's on the ground, I guess.
PJ, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Sure.
PJ Leash, degrees, as he said, Biological Sciences and Entomology at the UW-Madison, manager of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Go to that website. Just type in UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's got tons of stuff, some great photos, and a lot of good information. So really great to have him with us. Tomorrow at 11, we'll talk with former UW-Madison band director Mike LaCrone about the upcoming PBS Wisconsin special. And then at 11:45, talk with a DNA expert about finding out about your ancestry. So that's something good to look forward to tomorrow. But you know what? There's lots more good things to look forward to all afternoon here on the Ideas Network. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mieler.